gonna switch presenters and we'll get our PowerPoint up and we'll get this meeting started. All right, Alex, if we can go to the next slide.
That's good.
As usual, we have our meeting procedures to make sure that our meeting runs smoothly, and it just asks that everyone stay on mute if they are not speaking, and on camera if you can. Move on to the next, please. Okay, great. So welcome everyone to the Climate Justice Working Group meeting for today. I'm going to do a quick roll call. So we'll see, make sure we have all of our working group members on with us. I'm Rosa Mendez. I'm the Director of the Office of Environmental Justice for DEC. And we have Chris Cole.
Good afternoon, Rosa. I'm here.
Hey, Chris. And how about Neil?
Hey, good afternoon, Rosa and everybody. I'm here.
And Joe McNary. And how about Eddie?
How about me? Hello.
Hey, good afternoon. Elizabeth?
I got a text that she was having trouble logging on our
Oh, okay. I'll try to see if I see her in the attendee list. Next, do we have Rawa?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here.
Good afternoon. And Sono?
Present.
Jerry?
I am here. Good afternoon, folks.
Good afternoon. Donovan? Mary Beth?
Hi, everyone.
Hello. And Amy?
Hello, beautiful day.
Good afternoon. And I know Abigail is not able to join us today. And we'll see if we can get Elizabeth logged on. And today we have with us our team from Ilum. Do you want to introduce yourselves?
This is Alex Dunn.
This is Amanda Dwelly from Ilum.
And as usual, today we have with us Alana Cadell-Tucky from the EJ office. And today joining us as well is David Witt from the EJ office. And let's turn now to business items. Sorry if you see me distracted. I'm trying to see if I can get Elizabeth logged on at the same time. So last meeting, last week, we did not approve the minutes from May 24th because they were not shared timely. So for today, I'd like to approve the draft minutes from May 24th. You all should have received them through email and in the SharePoint. Do we have a motion to vote on the minutes from May 24th?
I'll make a motion.
Thanks. And a second?
A second.
Thank you. And then I can see most of your cameras. So if you can indicate with the thumbs up or thumbs down if you approve of the May 24th minutes. I'm just counting. and we have Elizabeth. I'm glad we were able to figure out the technical issues. And the minutes from May 24th are approved. Thank you. So our last meeting was just last week, June 15th, and I know that wasn't enough time to review those draft minutes, but if anyone has some reflection from that meeting and wants to open up discussion, please feel free. You're not seeing any. We also wanted to go back to a question that came up during the last meeting about Indigenous and tribal communities and how to reflect them in the disadvantaged communities. And I think we might have another slide on that, but we do have David Witt from our office, who's our Indian Nations Affairs Coordinator, and he's happy to answer questions. And what we do know is we have some data sets that we can use to identify Indigenous and tribal areas. But we also are engaging in an ongoing outreach and consultation with the nations, because we want the decision to be theirs about how they want to be reflected or as part of the disadvantaged communities conversation. So Dave, if you wanted to give a little more insight, I think we had another slide that talked about our next steps regarding that engagement.
Yeah, thanks, Rosa. Just want to make sure everyone can hear me, because I perpetually have issues with my webcam.
We have to.
DEC and other state agencies relate to Indigenous people as a government-to-government type of relationship. We try our best to respect the sovereignty of those Indigenous nations. And what this really means is that we don't work with them, work with Indigenous people as we would with other interest groups. We work with their government. So instead of working with Cayuga people, we work with the Cayuga Nation government. Instead of working with Seneca people, we work with the governments of the Seneca Nation of Indians and the Tonawanda Seneca. And this respects their sovereignty, and it follows policy that we have at DEC called CP42, Commissioner's Policy 42, which really outlines how we're supposed to relate to Indigenous nations. So respecting that policy, respecting the relationship that the state has with these individuals, with, you know, the nations, we've been reaching out to their governments, to their leadership, through various emails, through invitations, through face-to-face meetings and presentations at various meetings that we've had or that we've been invited to join with the nations. And we first brought up the topic more generally and broadly a couple years ago at a meeting that we hosted with EPA, with the Indian Nations in Syracuse, where we talked about CLCPA, and this was before CLCPA was signed. We talked about the EJ Act and kind of the pending legislative requirements that the agencies would have and how the state would move forward in climate change, battling climate change issues. Since then, we have followed up. We've had some brief discussions. Recently, we had another meeting with Indian Nation leadership where we gave them a follow-up of, the requirements of the CLCPA now that it's been signed and what the agencies have been doing. We introduced them to the Climate Justice Working Group as a concept. We have invited them to come and join us and meet with the working group. And we've invited them, just to come to us with any questions that they may have and that we can do our best to answer those questions. Ultimately, we want to see how Indigenous leadership wants to engage with the state on this particular topic. It's not so much the idea of whether or not to include Indigenous people within this consideration, but really trying to respect the sovereignty of the nations themselves and incorporate them to the degree and how they would like to be incorporated. We're waiting to hear back on that. We will be reaching out to them again in the next couple of weeks. at the basis of the CNICERTA at that level, at the agency level, to see how they would want to engage with the state on that particular thing. So we do have, on the other hand, we do have data that already reflects indigenous people within the state, census data, American Community Survey data. We have data related to ownership of tax parcels and reservation data. So we could bring them in. And in fact, DEC's potential environmental justice area layers do bring in indigenous people as aspects, as part of that minority populations. So it is something that is already incorporated to a degree. And we have that available to us. We just want to make sure that this is done respectfully to the status of the indigenous nations as sovereign nations, as opposed to just us trying to figure out and dictate how things will be done. So, and I know I ran through everything very quickly. If you have questions, feel free to ask.
David, I just have a brief question. I don't know if you mentioned it, but how are there in the state federally unrecognized First Nations? And if there are, how are they included in this?
So I clarify that. Are you asking if there are nations not recognized by the feds? Okay, yes, there's the Uncutchuk Nation, which is a state-recognized nation. That's located down on Long Island. It's in Mastic, which is close to Mauritius and Shinnecock, so that, you know, central area of Long Island. We also have some communities that are not state-recognized. There's the Montaukett Nation, which, you know, every legislative session, they have allies that introduce bills that recognize, you know, the existence of the Montaukett Nation, which New York State used to recognize. But without going too far into the detail, there's the Montaukett. And then we have the Ramapo Lenape, who are a New Jersey state-recognized nation that's located on the border of New Jersey and New York. They have populations, you know, people that live in New York as well. New York doesn't recognize them as of this point. So we do incorporate the Uncutchuk explicitly, just like we do any of the federally recognized nations. The other nations, we don't have, you know, explicit recognition, primarily because they don't have reservations in the state. If that changes in the future, then that would change how we approach it. However, we do take them in consideration as, you know, members of minority communities, of BIPOC people. So when we're looking at concentrations of population, you know, they're brought in that way. So,
David, it's Eddie. A quick question. I know you're waiting for formal responses, but can you share at least some initial reactions from Indigenous leaders to what we're doing and your invitation?
So we do have some interest, you know, informal statements of interest from a couple of leaders. Primarily, there's a traditional leader at the Cayuga that's interested in how, you know, this is moving forward. sorry about that. But when it comes to anything more detailed than that, part of it is the fact that, you know, we haven't received any formal responses, and so I don't really want to speak on behalf of the nations when it comes to it. And then part of it is that this is a fun, I don't want to say complicating, but this is just an aspect of consultation with the nations, particularly the Haudenosaunee. They have a consensus-based decision-making process, so it takes a long time to get responses back from the nations for certain issues. You know, in particular, this one as well, where they have to gather and discuss these issues and, you know, keep talking about it back and forth. And this could take the process of months before they come to an agreement on an answer that they're all comfortable with, that they then will share with the state. So they're aware of it, and we keep offering, we will offer again opportunities to discuss this, but until they have that internal opportunity to figure things out, you know, for themselves, we may not hear anything back from the nation. And usually when this is the case, they're pretty tight chested, you know, they keep things close to the chest just to avoid giving us improper, ideas of, they might be leaning one way, but in reality, they end up deciding to go the other way. So,
David, this is Rella. First of all, I just want to say thank you. Really appreciate you being on this call today and giving us all this really great information. One of the requests that was made to a letter to the DEC or maybe possibly the Climate Action Council, I'm not sure, was that since there is so much complexity and y'all are respecting Indigenous sovereignty, wouldn't it be really helpful to have an Indigenous panel advisory or something as part of this CAC that is separate, addressing all of these issues? And, one of the climate justice principles that we work by is that we don't speak for each other, right? Whether it's communities, whether it's people. And so I just feel like it might be much more coordinated if there was a panel advisory or just a body within the CAC, which has been a request.
So going along with the idea of respectful and not speaking for other people, this is why we're reaching out to the nation, to the nations. When it comes to the Haudenosaunee, they have a task force, the environmental task force, that is been authorized and charged by the traditional council to speak with New York State and with the federal government regarding environmental issues such as this. So we would likely see a response come back from the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force and their director, Dave Arquette, to further this. That would probably be along the lines of what I'm interpreting that you're saying, that we bring in and have this additional layer instead of bringing them into our process and our government structure and our bureaucratic structure. What we do is we try to meet them at their structure and meet within their process, and the HETF is the way that's been set up to do that. Does that answer your question?
Yes and no. I think it certainly speaks to the complexity of the issue, which I think we very much understand. And I think it would be helpful if we had at least one, if not more, representative to speak directly with us. Like, I appreciate you being here. I think you bring in a really great context from the state perspective. But I think, again, it would just be really helpful to have deeper engagements with actual Indigenous people that are leaders within the nations talking to us. And like I said, there was a letter that was circulated. I haven't seen a response to it. And I don't know where it stands. And so I think you've answered some of that. But I would just love to hear a little bit more. I think that's me. Sorry.
So, we did see that letter, and that's part of the aspect of inviting the nations to come and speak with the Climate Justice Working Group. We, we do want to act as that liaison. So I'm hoping and I'm hopeful that there will be individuals that are authorized by the various governments to come and speak with you about this and to have that dialogue between your group and their leadership organizations and so on. I could see HETF being that specifically for the traditional Haudenosaunee nations. When it comes to some of the other nations, Seneca Nation of Indians and so on, they'll probably end up having some, I could see as an opportunity that they would have someone from their environmental protection department come and speak with you. And if you'd like, it sounds like I can go and make that offer again and really highlight the fact that we've got members of the Climate Justice Working Group that really want to, meet with you and discuss things and learn from them, their perspective and how it can be done.
Hey, David. This is all really helpful, and to echo Rawa's point, I think that part of what we, some of us, maybe all of us, are uncomfortable about is, while there's a time-honored process that Indigenous leaders go through to arrive at a thoughtful consensus, we are also cognizant of just how many decisions are being made and how quickly this whole process is moving. And I think what we're struggling with is trying to find a way to respect the Indigenous nations' processes, while at the same time maximizing their exposure to what's being talked about and considered. Because what I worry about, and what we all worry about, is that decisions may end up getting made that the Indigenous leadership would have wanted to weigh in on, and may not have the opportunity because their process and this process are not aligned in any way to any kind of break switch to make sure that they're I don't have the answer to it, but I think that if you're able to re-engage with the leadership and find out what is a participation model that might work for them that doesn't run afoul of their consensus building process, but allows them to at least hear and weigh in to the degree they're comfortable with. I'm fumbling this, but you know what I'm saying, David. Like, I think we're all worried about decisions being made and Indigenous leadership not having the opportunity to decide if they want to weigh in at a key moment. But yeah.
Let me just add to what Eddie said, that the fact that they weren't part of this process from the beginning, to then force them to respond immediately seems fundamentally unfair. And because this has been a flawed process, we need to now come up with ways that honor their decision making and their engagement in this. I think I'm just trying to summarize what Eddie said.
Yeah, and I would echo Eddie. We are concerned with, and this isn't just the only case. We've had a lot of experience now with situations where the DEC has specific timeframes and regulatory and legally mandated timeframes on certain things, and that doesn't mesh well with a consensus-based decision-making process. And especially when you're consulting with nations on this particular or on any particular issue. So I definitely get that, and I can go and reach out, and once again, we'll make that invitation. I could see certain members of Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force then being given the opportunity to maybe not so much participate in these meetings, but rather at least listen and act as a conduit between Climate Justice Working Group and this process, and learn more about this process and their leadership. It is something that, like I said, we reached out back in 2019 was the first time, and then we followed up out since then. I would have liked to see more communication. It's been difficult, but part of it is bureaucratic structures of DEC. Part of it is the just the reality of the world and COVID and 2020 and all that. They've been hit so very hard because of that pandemic that there are just been certain things where they haven't been able to focus on anything external to the nations. They've been all internally focused, trying just make sure people live. So
I'll just add that we are engaging with the nations on more than just the Climate Justice Working Group. This is all part of how we want to coordinate with them on climate change issues. But I do want to move us forward because I know Alex has a lot she wants to show us today. But definitely this is a topic that we're going to continue to push on and make sure that that engagement is happening and that we are respecting the nation's process along with that. thank you everyone for your feedback.
I didn't want to shortchange that process because that's a really important discussion to have. So, okay, we're going to get into it. Amanda's going to talk through some of the health indicators. Last week, you all had some questions about the health indicators. By the way, if I'm looking away from you, it's because I'm looking at you. So, you know.
Hey, Alex, you're very quiet right now, and I'm not sure if it's just me or if everyone else is having that issue.
Can you hear me?
That's better.
Can you hear me better now? Okay.
Yes.
I can speak up and use my big girl voice if I need to also. Okay, so last week you all mentioned that you were curious about the health indicators and how they kind of interplay with other indicators. So today we're going to explore a little bit about health indicators. Then we're going to go into, we made a very cool little indicator map. So you guys can be like, well, I want to see about this. And so we'll look at the map together. Finally, at the end of that, we're going to go through, you know, the map that I went through at blistering speed last week. We had some technological issues, but it's finally up. I will email you the link so that you all can input data and review. So let's just get going. Amanda?
Great. Yeah, let's take a pause at this slide. So last week when we were talking about our overall list of indicators, there are some questions about the health indicators specifically. So just an update of where we are with indicators overall since November. So we've been generating a really long list of indicators to consider, which is at about 160 things already. And we actually did obtain and really look at data on about 90 things. So we looked at the distribution statewide, missing data, data quality, things like that. Also correlations. And from that list, from that data set that we have so far, we identified 40 indicators that seem to represent all of the concepts this group is trying to represent and had better statewide data. So we are still waiting for a few things. We have many of the health indicators. We're still waiting for a few and waiting for some environmental indicators. So in the next slide, we can talk a little bit about some of the considerations specifically for health indicators. So the agency started engaging with the DOH months ago, a while ago, in a series of workshops and discussions about what data they had, as well as what public health experts and epidemiologists thought were good indicators to capture what the CLCPA language is trying to capture. So, you know, considering, you know, everything the DOH has helped with, everything, you know, we've thought about, I think we can kind of group it into two categories that we've been considering. The first is the link to environmental or spatial factors, so kind of environmental or spatial relationships in this data. And the second is really the data availability and granularity. So we'll talk a little bit about those and then we can look at the indicator list. So first, thinking about environmental factors, the DOH helped us think about what health outcomes and health data might be more or less environmentally related or spatially related. Thinking about, you know, for chronic conditions, some exposures might have occurred many years prior or in places other than things were recorded. But they also helped us think about conditions, diseases where environmental factors might exacerbate or trigger acute events, and some health events or some health conditions are more exacerbated or triggered by environmental factors like asthma and myocardial infarction or heart disease. And then on the data availability and granularity side, this is fairly interesting. So there's a lot of conditions we might be interested in, but in terms of what data is available, the DOH and, you know, databases only really see a health outcome when it appears or is recorded in the data set. So that means things like births, deaths, ED visits, hospitalization, surveys, and registries. And there's less information on clinic or pharmacy visits. So for chronic conditions where someone might be more managing a condition, like diabetes without kind of an acute event, there might be less information on that. Another factor on the data availability side is what the frequency of that event is, how common, how frequent is that event? First, for, you know, the ability to share data, to have enough data points that you can calculate it at the sub-county level. And second, just to have, you know, a relatively stable indicator of that, that outcome over time. All right. And then also there were still some data considerations just in terms of the time it would take to get things for our purposes. And Neil, if you want to add anything here, I'd love to hear any additional considerations.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I hope you can hear me okay. I know the audio on my end is a little choppy, but hopefully I'm coming across clearly. So, Amanda, I think that was a great summary. You know, the other thing I would just mention is that we did look to things like Cal and VirusScreen as well, and including kind of looking into where we could, why or why not, some indicators were included on their end. So that helped to serve as a model. And I think given the time constraints, that was another source we looked to in helping to identify what we would move forward with and prioritize moving forward with. Again, trying to balance all those things you mentioned, along with the kind of the resources we had available to help pull it together on a short time frame, relatively speaking.
Yeah. And we certainly appreciate all the work your team has done to pull together a lot of data. A big thing is that a lot of the data needs to be geocoded before we can calculate rates for a certain area. So it is a lot of work. So Alex,
New York State's interesting to often tell people that, you know, we have some of the most highly densely populated counties in the country, and then some of the least densely populated counties when you look east of the Mississippi. So anyway, it's kind of interesting in that sense, but that impacts our numbers when we're looking at indicators statewide, which is what we've been trying to do here.
So that kind of rationale tees up this slide and why things might be on the left or the right at this point, given, you know, data constraints and some of those considerations. So the list on the left is what indicators we either have data on or are waiting for data on that we would propose to include in the criteria. And things on the right were indicators that we've certainly discussed and considered, but do not have data on at this point, and are not proposing to include at this point, either for, you know, that environmental factors reason, or in most cases, data availability and granularity. So the next slide, which I don't want to go to quite yet, has a little bit more information on each of the items on the right, which is, I think, what we really want to get into, what you want to get into. But I just want to give people a moment to see what is on the list, too. So we do have asthma ED visits, which is in Cal EnviroScreen. We have COPD ED visits. That's not in Cal EnviroScreen. We have heart attack hospitalization. California has heart attack ED visits. The DOH is helping us get information on premature deaths and low birth weight births. California has low birth weight births, but does not have premature deaths. We're also currently including information from the census on the percent of a census tract that has health insurance, the percent who reports having disabilities, and adults over age 65. And we're also working on, I don't know if we can include it yet based on GIS analysis, but distance to emergency, critical care, or urgent care facilities. And the items on the right, I know we've talked about a number of those. I might wait to get into those until the next slide. So maybe we can move to the next slide and just look at some of the reasons for those things on the right being on the right. And we also have a slide with all the reasons for the included indicators to be included. So here we have talked about COVID-19 before. Definitely understanding how very tied we've all seen the research show that is to socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, and a lot of other things. And so that would definitely be something we'd want to look at and evaluate on a map if it were available. As Neil's talked about before, it's not really readily available for this purpose quite yet. There's still cases under active investigation. It sounds like the testing rates aren't really prevalent across the state through the course of the pandemic. So there's still some data investigation there, but it's something that when the data becomes available, we could look at it. Neil, anything else you wanted to add on COVID? Okay. Heat stress, we've definitely talked about as well, understanding how tied that is to climate change vulnerability. There is data out there on ED visits and hospitalization related to heat stress. However, this falls into the category of one of those lower frequency events where it might either be unavailable or unreliable at the sub-county level. So it is kind of too small to report at the level we'd want it. However, though we might not have the health outcome, we have done a lot to try to include heat vulnerability. So we just added an indicator for forecasted high temperature 90 plus days in 2050. We have information on vegetative cover and road data, and I mean road density, which relates to the urban heat island effect. We have some information on housing quality and housing costs, which might relate to the presence of air conditioning. Unfortunately, we can't get at the presence of air conditioning exactly, but we can get some other housing related factors. And then we have other health vulnerabilities, as you saw in the previous slide, that might make folks more vulnerable to heat stress. Anything to add there?
Amanda, I'm sorry,
Eddie, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, are we taking questions as we get to these indicators, or should we wait? Hold on till you look.
Yeah, feel free. Let's talk about each indicator.
Gotcha. Thanks. And by the way, there are also questions in the chat, so I don't want to jump the line. While you look up that chat, I'll step into the line, but not for long. So, quick question, Neil. I when it comes to heat stress, I wonder how the state captures and accounts for heat related deaths. And the reason I'm asking is because some of us have some questions about how the city of New York, for example, the methodology they use to calculate heat related deaths. It's our understanding that heat-related deaths are only counted as such by the city of New York if they happen during an actual heat wave. And of course, heat waves are meteorologically defined as 3 consecutive days of 90 degree weather and above. So if you have 2 days of 90 degree weather and the third day it dips to 89, technically, you're not in a heat wave, but if you're passing away during those 3 days, you're not therefore counted as a heat-related death, given the city's methodology, which to us sounds epidemiologically or medically, it doesn't sound like it's a medical category, or it feels arbitrary to us. So I guess the reason I'm asking is as we, at least in New York City, some of us are questioning how the city collects heat-related deaths and calculates that morbidity. How does the state capture? Do they defer to the localities and just take whatever methodologies, even if they're inconsistent with each other or maybe not are necessarily medically based? Do you guys just accept the rates that you get from the counties, or do you all have your own independent definition of what a heat-related death is, and then do you apply that to deaths in New York State? I'm just curious about how the state lands on that definition of heat-related death.
Sure. So I could say that we've tended to focus more on heat stress, hospitalizations, and ED visits. So I'll just start there and mention that. But we've looked at mortality a little bit, and I think usually we're focusing on the summer months and not necessarily specific we're calculating these indicators. So we look at May, June, July, August, September, because we focused on the warmest months and look at
that time. Yeah, Neil, I don't know if anyone else is having problems, but you're breaking up.
Yeah. We lost you.
I can try. Let me try that again and see if this is if this works better. What I would say is we don't apply that additional criteria when we're calculating heat stress metrics, whether it be ED visits and hospitalization, which we have focused on more, or mortality. I could talk to some colleagues in New York City and try to get a little bit more information about the rationale they're using. I know they think through these things quite a bit, as I'm sure you guys know too. But we don't at this point have a kind of additional filter like that.
The reason I'm asking, Neil, is that I'm just finished this one thought. The reason I'm asking is because a few years ago, the official heat-related death count from New York City was about 114. I just saw a note in the chat from Sopnal that there was a recent report that upped that number to 350. And there have been yet other academic reports that have estimated the number of heat-related deaths in New York City to be closer to over 600. So we find it deeply troubling that peer-reviewed academic research, the official New York City number 3 years ago and whatever this recent number someone was talking about, are all different, in the hundreds. So this is really deeply concerning to us. And so if the state is, I guess it's the straight question for you is, how does the New York State Department of Health calculate the number of heat-related deaths in New York City? Do you have your own number, or do you rely on the city of New York's numbers?
So right now we don't publish, we haven't published a heat related mortality indicator. We publish heat stress hospitalizations and ED visits. But we haven't in the past thought about adding a filter for extreme heat. That would have to happen during a heat wave. I don't know the specific study that Sonal mentioned, but I know there's been a lot of work that suggests that if it's not reported in the notes or in the death certificate that it was heat related, it wouldn't show up as heat related in the records we're looking at. So I don't know if the studies that have shown higher numbers, they might have done some additional work beyond just looking at the death record to be able to classify it as a heat-related death. That could also have some impact. So better, more in-depth review of the circumstances surrounding the death.
So I'm going to jump in, mostly because I think there's two things that are happening. One is, I think, increasing or improving the indicators that we could have to add eventually into the model. And Elizabeth, I want to make sure that we give time to to your comment as well and your question. The other thing here is also what we really want to talk about too is that we think we're going to capture a lot of the things that we don't have data for or that we're excluding at this point through other means, and we do want to show that to you too. So I do want to jump in and give space to Elizabeth for her question.
Thank you, Alex. I had asked a question about the NIHS. They've done a lot of work on epigenetics, and we're talking about communities that have sustained health disparities over generations. So I don't really know how that shows up. The other thing that I had a question about was the absence of HIV/AIDS. I don't know why that's not in there. It is like diabetes, like everything else, and it makes people in our community particularly susceptible to the impacts of extreme weather events. And I think we need to make sure that that's in there. And then the other thing that we didn't talk about, or I don't see, and maybe it's in there, is mold, and how mold not only affects the autoimmune system, but increases when there is extreme weather events. So I just wanted to make sure that we included those things. And if there is a reason for them not being included, if you could share, that'd be great.
So Neil, do you want to
sure,
say anything
I'll
about
take a shot at it. I think that the epigenetics are, oh.
Go for it.
Sorry, can you hear me? Okay. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I think the epigenetics line of research is really interesting for, you know, I think what we understand about health in general. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have access to any data that would allow us to come up with a kind of a state level indicator for this project. Can be informed by that. But I think it's certainly a topic of interest. In terms of HIV, I'd have to look. My guess is that, again, at a census tract level, thinking statewide, the numbers would get too small, but I could look into more recap the folks who work with in that program and get their thoughts. And then, again, on mold, we don't have a statewide source. I know, like in New York City, for example, they've done some surveys and put out some data. I think at the neighborhood tabulation area, some of their sub-county geographies that capture information about visible mold or water damage in homes, which is kind of an indicator of mold. Statewide, we don't have a similar data source that would allow us to create a kind of a sub-county indicator. But that's certainly a great question, one we've thought about in the context of heat and extreme weather events.
And I think mold and housing quality is an area where we might look to what other indicators and other categories pick up some of that. So what do we have on the housing side? We have age of housing. We have rental costs as a percentage of income, and you typically see, you might see more mold in properties that are less maintained.
Amanda, do you also have proximity to brownfields? Because fugitive dust is real, and it ends up in, it creates sick buildings. Do you have a category called sick buildings, where you've got buildings that are in the midst of brownfields where these particles can be in the windows, can be inside the house, and create exposure?
We have a bunch of proximity variables that are captured on the environmental burden side of things to all types of industrial and manufacturing sites, remediation sites, landfills. There's a pretty long list, and the DEC is helping us gather a lot more on hazardous sites. And that is on a different slide that we could go to, but with that, we don't even have the complete list right now of all the different facilities we're trying to capture. But we do have a bunch of air toxic staff helping us think about all the facilities that might be hazardous.
We're going to steal that. Well, we might, Elizabeth, steal your sick houses label, though, because that's a cool one to be able to capture that, or at least that concept through mm-hmm. some of these indicators.
We definitely do want to capture that. And I mean, asthma as well. This is a case where, again, as you see, the column on the right is trying to show how we can triangulate to the thing we're trying to capture. And, you know, those asthma ED visits might also help to capture people whose asthma was exacerbated by sick buildings.
One of the things that we haven't talked about as much, but we found very high correlations, like really high correlations across many of these indicators. So what that tells us is that there are some indicators that we may not have, but we're capturing in other ways, to Sonal's point, in the comments. And that's going to help us to, as Amanda says, triangulate and really get at the concept of sick homes, heat stress, you know, different health issues. And then for those that we see gaps where we really want to capture those data, we need to list those out again for future iterations that where we don't have it, because we are running on multiple streams here where we have the indicators we have, we've got a GIS team coding things, we're working with all the agencies to do that. Some of those will be included in the current model, and some of them are going to have to be included in later updates. We will, of course, be explicit on which ones those are.
So with our remaining 6 minutes here, there is information here on cancer and diabetes. We would love to talk about that, but I wonder if we might want to look at any maps. Where would folks like to go? We could look at maps of some of the data that we do have, or we could talk through these on this slide.
Please, let us impress you with maps. Okay, I'm doing it. We're doing it. I wanted to show you one of the tools that we have been doing to assess and look at the correlations between the indicators that we do have. On the right here, I have all of the things that we've ported in, and then you can see how they look. So right now I'm looking at, asthma ED. This is what this one looks like. And if we scroll into certain places, we can start seeing where things fall. And honestly, that just helps us to see what's going on with air quality. But then also, like, okay, so air quality is in the red over here in Buffalo. Let's look at ED visits.
COPD. Oh, it's floating.
I got a lot of data in here. So there's a substantial amount of overlap. But there are some differences. And what we're trying to look for here with everything that we're including is overlap, but not complete overlap. So like some, because we're creating this patchwork of imperfect data points. So in this case, we want to see this. So COPD adds something more than just asthma visits. So that's cool.
How about that PM2.5 annual to see it, the PM2.5 concentrations? Maybe
and zoom out a little bit. Yeah, let's go. Here you can start seeing that this also has gradations that will help inform us as well, because it kind of pulls out in this very beautiful way.
We could look at temperature to the 90 plus degrees.
Yeah, that one is actually a really important one. So let's go down to high temp 90 days. Or is it temp project? Which one do you want?
Temp project 90. That's the 2050 projections.
Temp project.
So let's zoom out a little bit.
Zoom out for that.
So these are forecasted high temperatures. And so we did look at multiple kind of health vulnerability indices, and some of the common components of those were temperature projections, as well as land use characteristics like vegetative cover, developed land, roads. So we do have vegetative cover as well. We have agricultural land. Any indicators people want to see a map of?
Is this one heat you're showing, Amanda?
Yeah, temperature projections.
In 2050, right, Amanda?
Mm-hmm. And then the current one is the other variable. Yeah.
Here's the historical.
I just have a quick question on that map you just had up. Why is there a gap up by Fort Drum, Watertown?
So there's gaps in our maps right now, all of our maps. Based on our scoring approach. So right now our scoring, we're using both burdens and vulnerabilities, and a lot of the vulnerabilities data is all people data and social data. There are some census tracts that have very few people, so all the people data is very unreliable. So for our very initial scoring, we excluded 138 tracts out of 4,918, so just over 2%, that we're not going to score in that multiplicative approach that uses all the people data, but we're going to probably, and we know we need to talk about this score just based on the burdens alone. So this just says we're kind of holding out those for kind of separate analysis that doesn't include sociodemographic or health data.
Frankly, we're excluding them because we want to see. Right now, it's like it glares out at you when you don't have the information. We have 2 minutes left, and we covered a lot, but we also have a lot of things to cover. So I want to mention this. After this meeting, we finally, last night, got the ground truthing website up and running, so we will send you a link to this so that you can do things, and I will also make sure that we include a tutorial on how to use it, because it's going to need a tutorial. And then you can add in data right over here, add your name in, add a reason for whether you agree or disagree with certain things, and then hit submit, and it will give us a lot of information. So stay tuned for that. It's finally up and running, so yay! Very excited about that. And then I think we also, I would love to hear your feedback on other questions you have about indicators. We're running so fast, we have so much to do and so much to cover, but we can't cover it in an hour. So I would ask each of you, please, to help think about what is really important for you. What's really important for us to develop the models is getting this ground truthing. But where do you feel uncertain? Where do you feel worried? It's the whole process. Please tell us. That's fine. But share that with me and Rosa so that we can make sure that we're covering those things as well. And our timeline is tight. We will be following up. And I urge, you know, we're going to have some one-hour meetings coming between now and July 20th, which is our next two-hour meeting. So let's try to figure out a way to schedule those so that we can get through a little bit more of this. And we're at time. Rosa, is there anything you wanted to say? Last final words?
Thank you, Alex. So for next steps, you all will be receiving, as Alex indicated, a link to that mapping tool and some tutorial on how to use it. And of course, Alex and I are always available to help with that. You'll also be receiving, or you already had some of the slides that we wanted to go through today in terms of the indicators. And we will be firming up the 1 hour earlier July meeting date so that we can continue with this work. So I thank you all again for your participation today, and we will continue with our work moving forward. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you all. Have a good week.
Bye, everyone.